supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dave Heller, and this is Newsworks Tonight.
In the center, play the goal!
Soccer fans in Philly are feeling, well, kind of like that guy. FIFA, the sport's governing body, announced this week that North America will be hosting the World Cup in 2026. That gives the city a shot at hosting some matches during the month-long tournament. But as WHYY's Aaron Moselle reports, it's not a sure bet.
On Thursdays, lunchtime at Penn Park in West Philly means one thing: pick up soccer. On this 80-degree day, there's about a dozen people weaving up and down the manicured field. Godfred Mensa is on the shirt side of this shirt-skins matchup. He's a doctor in Old City, and he's thrilled that World Cup soccer may come to Lincoln Financial Field, the home of the Philadelphia Eagles.
I'd definitely be one of the first people at the stadium to watch the games if it does come here. So,
why is that?
You know, you just want to be around people who enjoy the game, who have passion for the game, who just want to be part of something bigger.
Mensa's teammate Hanuk Ayu says Philly is a good candidate to play host.
There's a strong fan base here. I think in terms of transportation, convenience to getting to the games, I think all of those infrastructure pieces are in place. So I think it's just as good as any other place.
FIFA is expected to choose 16 host cities. A handful of them will be in Canada or Mexico. The rest will be in the U.S. Victor Matheson studies sports economics at the College of the Holy Cross in Massachusetts. He says FIFA uses a variety of metrics to evaluate each of the cities hoping to make the final cut, including the kind of stuff Ayu was talking about.
The big thing is going to be the stadium itself. How big is it? Is it a modern stadium? What sort of facilities do you have for players, fans, and officials?
Matheson says Philly checks a lot of boxes, but it could get tripped up by something it can't control: geography. Matheson thinks Philly could be a dark horse because it's so close to New York, widely expected to be one of the host cities, possibly for the final match of the tournament.
They'll probably not try to cluster teams together and stadiums together, but rather spread them out. This gives you the advantage of being able to attract local audiences from kind of a wider geographical distance.
If there's a silver lining to Matheson's prediction, it's that Philly has a history of hosting big international soccer games.
USA come away with a victory. 5-0.
Like this blowout against Nigeria in 2003 during the Women's World Cup, though the tournament only took place in the U.S. because China was grappling with a SARS outbreak. Larry Needle leads the committee pushing to earn Philly a spot in the World Cup's lineup in 2026. He says the city has proved itself by hosting major events with huge crowds. Most recently, it was the NFL draft, but we've also had the Democratic National Convention, even a visit from the Pope. All of them went down without incident.
We know how to do big events, certainly, and do them well.
FIFA will announce the final cities sometime in 2020.
Good pressure. Very nice.
North Philly resident Najee Morrison is lacing up his cleats so he can join the game at Penn Park. Like the rest of the players here, he wants Philly to be part of the World Cup 8 years from now. But he's also excited it will be in the U.S., period. That's because he thinks all the attention will only make the game more popular here, and hopefully make it easier for him to find a good pickup game anywhere in the city.
If you look at Mexico, like, there's people playing soccer 24/7 down there. Like, you could literally just probably walk down the street into a park. Instead of people playing basketball, they would just be playing soccer.
For now, he'll have to keep traveling to West Philly on Thursdays to play. Aaron Moselle, WHYY News.
I'm betting $20 on Germany to win the World Cup and $20 on the New Jersey Devils to win Lord Stanley's Cup. Let's go.
That's New Jersey Governor Phil Murphy placing the state's first legal sport bet on Monmouth Park. Thanks to a U.S. Supreme Court decision and a new state law, sports betting has come to racetracks and casinos across the Garden State. And now, a popular shopping center in New Jersey may be next, as WHYY's Joe Hernandez reports.
Cross the Ben Franklin Bridge into Jersey, head east, and after about 10 minutes, the big box stores come into view. There's a Wegmans grocery store, Best Buy, Home Depot, a cheesecake factory, and pretty soon this Cherry Hill strip mall could be home to a sports betting venue too. The site is the former location of the Garden State Park racetrack, and under the state's new law, even former racetracks will be allowed to offer sports betting.
I think it's a relatively good thing.
Chuck Kahn is the mayor of Cherry Hill. He says there are benefits to having sports betting in the township. For example, it could mean higher sales for the nearby stores. But there are downsides, too. Traffic could get worse, and a spike in visitors could mean extra work for Cherry Hill cops.
It could bring a higher level of service for our, police department if it brings the wrong element of people.
Outside Wegmans, opinions were mixed about what the addition of a sports betting venue could mean for Cherry Hill. Chris Dent, who drove in from Philadelphia to do some shopping, said the parking lot was already crowded enough.
Same parking. I mean, you got to rethink the entire area. One of these big boxes is going to have to go.
But Alan Polonsky of Cherry Hill disagreed.
Traffic is bad enough as it is. It's not going to change anything.
So you think if they opened a place here for sports betting, it wouldn't change much?
I don't think it would have any significant effect one way or the other.
That sounds like a draw to me. From the New Jersey desk, Joe Hernandez, WHYY News.
In the Philadelphia region, we tend to think of the U.S. border as being very far away, perhaps near a dusty desert in New Mexico or a forest in upstate New York. Let's talk about a time when a major border stop was right on the Delaware River waterfront. Joining me is WHYY's Laura Benchoff. Hi, Laura.
Hey, Dave.
This place hasn't operated for 100 years. Why are we bringing it up today?
So, Dave, last fall, WHYY did a story on immigration with a podcast called Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting. And when we aired that story, we asked our listeners for questions about immigration. And given that that topic's in the news a lot today, many people just asked for basic context. You know, how does the immigration system work and how did it used to work? To get at that last question, I went to a small park in South Philadelphia that's kind of wedged between the Delaware River and a busy road. It doesn't look like much now, but this place, Pier 53, used to be Philadelphia's Ellis Island. While I was there, I talked to a woman named Susan McEninley, who's been helping to preserve its history.
Most of the immigration was around the time the Southern and Eastern Europeans were coming here. The peak year for immigration for this pier was 1913.
Massive steamships docked right here and dropped off hundreds of thousands of immigrants, mostly from Europe, around the turn of the 20th century.
Laura, this location, though, is not where people enter the United States now, though you spoke to a listener who has a specific question about immigration in the past.
That's right. So reporters at Reveal and I, we tackled a few listener questions about immigration. And mine came from a woman in Montgomery County named Judy Idelson.
Hi. Hey, Judy.
Found it.
I did. Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you, too.
She's a psychologist living in Bala Cynwyd, and she knows a lot about immigration because she works with immigrants applying for asylum or other kinds of status in the United States. She documents their trauma to help their cases. Idelson knows the bar is pretty high to come live in the U.S. today, and that got her wondering.
I think a lot of people with European backgrounds think they somehow are more American or they're more legitimate in their American citizenship. And I want to know, how did their families get here?
Basically, she wants to know how Europeans, white people, came to the U.S. in the 19th and 20th centuries. And did they follow the law? Buried in her question, there's also kind of a confession about her own family's past, but we'll get to that a little later. To get started, Judy and I call up Columbia University history professor May Nye.
You know, until the 1920s, we had virtually an open door from Europe, that is, into the United States.
Not all immigrants from Europe were viewed kindly then, but Nye says if you could get yourself here, government officials didn't ask too many questions.
They wanted to make sure you had a little cash in your pocket so you wouldn't become a public charge. They wanted to make sure you didn't have what was called a dangerous or loathsome disease. They wanted to make sure you weren't a prostitute.
Around the turn of the 20th century, about 20 million European immigrants streamed through this open door into the U.S. They came from Italy, from Germany, from Poland, from all over Europe. Meanwhile, Mainai told me and Judy, the U.S. had started banning entire groups of people based on their race.
Congress passed the Chinese Exclusion Act in 1882.
Was that just Chinese? I'm sorry to interrupt.
Well, in 1882, it was Chinese, but later Japanese were excluded and people from South Asia were excluded.
Pretty much anyone from Asia was barred from coming to the U.S. After the turn of the 20th century, just as immigration from Southern and Eastern Europe was booming, suspicion of those European immigrants was also on the rise. Labor unions worried immigrant workers would drive down wages, and there was a political movement to preserve the so-called racial purity of white America. Stanford University historian Richard White says that to justify keeping out the bad European immigrants, these groups relied on a list of nasty stereotypes.
Catholics, they can't really be Republican citizens because they'll do whatever the Pope and the priest tells them to do. Jews, the argument was Jews have no loyalty to anybody but other Jews.
That list was long.
The Italians are violent. The Italians are naturally thieves. Other groups are lazy. They're ignorant. They simply cannot be educated.
Eventually, those groups that wanted to limit immigration got their way. In the early 1920s, the U.S. passed a series of laws creating quotas that culminated in the Johnson-Reed Act of 1924. Where before there was an open door, now there was a line that was first come, first served. And it was much longer for people from Southern and Eastern Europe. Historian Richard White says that when those laws went into effect, some people just started sneaking around them.
Canadian border is wide open. There's just no way to patrol that border. And it's also largely true of the Mexican border.
In the 1920s, the U.S. Immigration Service estimated about 1.5 million immigrants living in the U.S. then could have snuck into the country. Articles in the New York Times described people from Czechoslovakia and Poland paying smugglers with boats in Cuba or to get them across the U.S. border with Canada. White says that's what his own Irish grandfather did in 1924. After a trip back to Ireland a few years later, he applied to live in the U.S. legally. Sort of.
I've seen his petition for citizenship, and virtually everything on it except for his name is either a lie or wrong. I mean, he even has his own birthday wrong. He has his wife's birthday wrong. He can't list the correct number of his children.
Lying on official paperwork? That's breaking immigration law. But he and many European immigrants got away with it. A couple of decades later, listener Judy Idelson's dad did the same thing. These quota laws had kept Jews like him, people who had escaped death during the Holocaust, from coming to the U.S.
My father's name was Shaika Ivansky, and he was born in a town called Janova in Lithuania.
He was a teenager when the German army invaded.
He lost his parents, his brother, and his sister during the war.
Shaika escaped to a Jewish ghetto and took a new name, essentially pretending to be someone else. Judy says for the next 4 years, he lied whenever he had to, just to stay alive.
He was in Dachau, in a work camp, and they needed men to paint. And so he said he was a painter. He was not a painter, but he said he was a painter.
When the war ended, he made his way to a refugee camp in Germany. To get out of limbo and be with the woman he would marry, Judy's dad told a different kind of lie to the U.S. government.
My father had to pretend that he was going to rabbinical school, that he was going to study to become a rabbi in order to get a visa to come into the country.
He got a letter of admission from a school in Baltimore that he used to get a student visa. Judy's dad had no intention of becoming a rabbi. He later became a bookkeeper. And she told me it didn't hit her until after he died that what he did was really serious.
Did he become a criminal by U.S. immigration laws? He did. That was immigration fraud.
She says he worried he'd be found out. But he wasn't. He got married, had kids, and lived into old age. Judy says she's struck by how back then, the U.S. didn't devote so many resources to enforcing immigration laws, and that helped people like her dad.
Even though there were quotas, if people snuck in and they got here one way or another, they would make their life, they'd start a family, they weren't living for the rest of their lives in fear.
If Shaika were coming to the U.S. today, she says she doesn't think his story would have ended that way. Laura Benshoff, WHYY News.
Thanks to listener Judy Idelson for sharing her story with us. If you'd like to hear answers to more immigration questions, visit revealnews.org/episodes. From Chris Christie to Chris Matthews, Steven Singer to Steve Somm, luminaries from the Philadelphia region are amply represented in local luminary Michael Smirkanish's new book. The author, SiriusXM radio host, CNN TV host, Philadelphia Inquirer columnist, husband, and father of four, joins me now to talk about his new book entitled Clowns to the Left of Me, Jokers to the Right, American Life in Columns. Michael, thanks so much for joining
us. Thank you for taking an interest in it.
It's a wonderful book. Describe first how it's organized, roughly in three parts.
So I wrote for the Philadelphia Inquirer and Daily News post-September 11 for a 15-year time period, actually now going on longer than that. And I wanted to revisit many of those columns, 1,047 by my count, and selected 100 of them that I thought were worthy and ultimately broke them down into four different categories that they deal with life, they deal with politics, there's a catch-all, and there are some profiles, particularly with people from the Philadelphia area, some well-known, some not so well-known, but I frankly could have published a book of 100 just profile columns. That would have been fun as well.
But at least as much fun as some of the miscellany, your dog Winston, your hairstyle, the Gladwin Village luncheonette. Each one has an addenda, an afterword, where you more or less bring it up to date.
Well, I wanted to revisit some of them and say, wow, I wish I'd never published that, or to thump my chest, or to add some relevance for what's gone on in the intervening years.
I suppose musings on Miss America is one that falls into the category of, oh my gosh.
Well, maybe I shouldn't have said it that way. It's true that I think that column was published 16 years ago. And at the time, it was not the swimsuit issue, but they were revamping the rules and trying to de-emphasize the physicality of the quote-unquote pageant, now they would say competition. And yeah, I really did write, bring back the busty baton twirler. In the era of hashtag Me Too, not words I would have used.
Does the title of the book refer to the lack of nuance left either in media or obviously in politics in 2018?
I think that the control that certain media personalities hold over the most loyal of primary voters is a short explanation of how we've moved so far in the last 30 years. I say this to people and they're mystified by it. On Ronald Reagan's watch, 60% of the Senate was comprised of moderates. 60%. And look where we are today. There are literally none left in both the House and the Senate. There are a multitude of reasons as to how we became so polarized, but at the top of my list, if I were offering them to you, would be the role of the media. Flip the dial from time to time. I try not to go to bed at night without listening to what Sean Hannity's opening monologue consists of, and to do the same with Rachel Maddow. I've changed in the span of those last 15 years. I think that the Republican Party that I joined when I was 18 and growing up out in Bucks County has changed significantly. I don't think that Ronald Reagan or George Herbert Walker Bush could capture a nomination of this Republican Party.
Let alone an Arlen Specter in Pennsylvania.
No, no. But here's what I would say. Have my views changed? They absolutely have changed over time. I think that all of our views change. What's different about me, and as evidenced by the book, is that mine are chiseled in granite. So you know at any one time on a multitude of issues how I saw the world.
Your dream has been half met, although Wawa still doesn't sell beer. You can buy fireworks in Pennsylvania now.
Yeah, finally. Boy, you really did read it, and I appreciate that very much.
You hold forth, and then the viewer, the listener, reader has the opportunity to respond. Except in one of your columns, you talk about NPR's decision to unplug that opportunity.
Which I applaud. I applaud what NPR did relative to public comments. And my argument, by the way, is that this is really a negative impact on our civil discourse, the anonymity, in the same way that social media allows people to say things where you can't see their faces, and it just draws, in some circumstances, the worst out of people. I then make the observation that when that column was published in the Inquirer, there were X comments appended to it, and I read none of them.
We're both classic rock aficionados. How did you have the temerity to sit in the front row at MSG and hurl insults at Roger Waters?
How did he?
And then Led Zeppelin, daring them to come back on the concert circuit?
Well, how did Waters have the temerity within 3 miles of Ground Zero, as we were then still calling it, on or about the fifth anniversary of September 11, to launch into a diatribe about prisoner rights at Guantanamo? I wasn't in a mood to hear it 5 years after September 11. But this is another great instance where, at the time of publication of the book, I did a tabulation of how many are still being held at Guantanamo and have not yet even had charges filed against them. And I had to say, that's not right. Roger Waters was correct in that instance.
If I recall, your grandparents came from coal country, Luzerne
True.
County.
That's absolutely right.
Not to generalize, but probably largely Trump territory.
Many Trump supporters, a butter knife away from me at the Thanksgiving table.
Must be quite lively or deathly quiet.
No, we choose not to get into it.
Got it.
Yeah, I get enough of that, Monday through Friday and Saturday on television. If it's a holiday, we kind of put it off to the side.
Personal disclosure, it's been as edifying and entertaining talking to you as it was reading your book.
Oh, thank you.
Thanks for joining us on Newsworks tonight.
Thank you.
Michael Smirkanish, author of Clowns to the Left of Me, Jokers to the Right, American Life in Columns. That's all for tonight's show. Newsworks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. Find us on your favorite podcast app or listen back at whyy.org/news. Thanks for listening. I'm Dave Heller, Newsworks Tonight.